This episode of The Ready Room is brought to you by Audible.com, offering more than 180,000 titles for smartphone, tablet, and desktop. To get a free audiobook of your choice and help Trek FM at the same time, visit audibletrial.com/trekfm. And also by Enterprise in Space, an international program of the nonprofit National Space Society. Find out how you can help science and education and become a virtual crew member aboard the NSS Enterprise Orbiter by visiting enterpriseinspace.org. And want to join the conversation and share your thoughts on this episode? Join the Babel Conference, our listeners group on Facebook. Just type Babel, B-A-B-E-L, into the Facebook search field. We look forward to seeing you there.
Hi, this is Michael Dorn, Lieutenant Commander Worf from Next Generation and Deep Space Nine, and you're listening to Trek FM.
Welcome to The Ready Room, show number 213. Welcome to Cyrusville. I'm Christopher Jones, and with me today is Justin Oser. We'll be talking about some Star Trek news, including the Deep Space Nine documentary's new video vault, and LeVar Burton bringing Carl Sagan's Cosmos to life. Then in the feature, we're joined by Aaron Harvey and Luke Weir to discuss the Enterprise episode, Vanishing Point. So let's step into the Ready Room. Hello, Justin. Welcome to the Ready Room for the very first time. We talk a lot outside of podcasting. We play words with friends together, but it's your first time joining me on the show, so welcome.
Hi, Chris. Very excited to be here for my first time on the Ready Room.
Yeah, it's going to be fun. We're going to do news, and then we're going to be joined by Luke Weir from Hyperchannel and Aaron Harvey from Saturday Morning Trek to talk about Enterprise of all things. But before we do that, we've got a few news stories to, in fact, talk about. And the first thing I want to talk about is Deep Space Nine. I'm a big Niner, as many people know, and some of you may not. I co-host our Deep Space Nine podcast called The Orb with Matthew Rushing. And we had been wanting a behind-the-scenes documentary of Deep Space Nine for years. And we've been waiting. We've had the opportunity to have some people on our podcast, like Michael Dorn and Aaron Eisenberg, and get some behind-the-scenes, but finally, Ira and the crew have put together this DS9 documentary, and the filming is coming along. They've released a thing called Video Vault for those of us who have contributed, and that's what we're going to talk about a little bit today. And Justin, I think you have supported this project as well, right?
I have, yes. I'm actually a big Niner as well, and I supported it several times because they kept coming up with, you know, different perks and incentives that looked great. I was very excited about it when they had the campaign back in February and March, and I've been kind of watching the progress. They've been doing interviews and getting things together for it, so it was exciting to see that they had released this video vault for donors so that they can see a little bit more about the progress that's going on.
Well, TrekCorps has a nice roundup of tweets in particular from people who have been involved in the project, and they've been commenting after they've been shooting with the crew, and we're going to share a few of those. But since we're talking about Video Vault at the moment, if you're a contributor, I think this is available at most levels, right?
Yeah, $5 and above.
$5 and above. So you will have received by now, you should have received by now, a password. Your username is probably your email address, but also a password, and then you can go to the backer kit and access this video vault. And Justin, I know you've been in there, you've been looking around, so tell us a little bit about what they've got up there right now and what they're going to be doing.
Yes, yeah, so there a couple things they have. They did some great videos during the campaign. They've included that. They have, I think, what they call some exclusive videos, which they have an interview with Nana Visitor and with Terry Farrell, which I think may have been out there before. But the thing that was really interesting is it looks like they'll be having monthly updates And they just put in a monthly update where the DS9 documentary crew went with Adam Nimoy, who's directing the documentary, and Ira Stephen Bear, of course, was the showrunner for Deep Space Nine. They took a little trip to the CBS archives, and it was great to kind of see them walking around in some of the different rooms. They had a shelf that had binders. You know, I think there was a binder for each Deep Space Nine episode. What I found was really interesting is they'd take out these binders and it looked like there were little slides in there. And one of the things that happened during the documentary, it was extremely successful. They had a $150,000 initial goal and they got up to almost $650,000. So they had a couple of stretch goals. And the last one involved trying to actually remaster into HD some scenes from Deep Space Nine. So it looked like almost like there were slides of maybe effect shots or things. So maybe they're working on that. And that's one of the reasons they went to the archive. But they also showed different props. I think one of the things they showed was the costume that Iggy Pop wore as Nvorta Yellgren. Mm-hmm. They had some Latinum props and some other things. So it was fun to see, you know, some of those things behind the scenes that we don't often see, and to see that they're going into the CBS archives to hopefully, presumably, you know, do some remastering of a couple scenes for the documentary.
Well, that would be nice for sure. And if we're lucky, maybe that can lead to a remastering of the series down the road. Of course, there are a number of very valid reasons why we don't have a remastered DS9 yet or a Voyager. And I don't want to get into those right now because we've talked about them here on the show many times and elsewhere on the network. But you never know what the future may hold. And if they get in and they start doing that and they find out that maybe it's feasible, I don't know if the ones they might choose for the documentary will include any of the big space battles, which are one of the big obstacles, I think, in terms of things that would have to be recreated. Who knows? But it's nice to hear that they're doing that.
Yeah, I think that was one element people got really excited about. Now, I don't think they've guaranteed anything, but they've said, okay, we have the money to negotiate with CBS and see what we can do. I think what was interesting in that monthly update video is they specifically pulled out the binder for Emissary, the pilot. So I don't know if they're planning on doing something with that or just happened to pick it up off the shelf, but I'm sure we'll find out.
It was the closest one to the door, Justin. It's episode one.
So. Yeah, probably something like that. But it was just, you know, it was great to see that they've been working on it. You know, they've been doing all of these interviews. I mean, I think they've tried to interview everybody that they possibly can. And one of the things they mentioned before is that they did some interviews at the, I think it was like a 20th reunion for Deep Space Nine at Star Trek Las Vegas in 2013. And they got some interviews there, which I'm happy that they did that because Avery Brooks was there, but, you know, he hasn't since then, I think, been much on the convention circuit or been in contact with them at all about the documentary. So at the very least, maybe they got some interviews with him there.
Maybe. Yeah. It's very disappointing to me that he's not a part of this because pretty much everyone else is. And he's such an important part of the show. I don't know. Maybe I'm hoping that by the time that they complete this, that they'll somehow be able to involve him so we can keep our fingers crossed on that anyway. You mentioned that they said they had the money to negotiate with CBS. I assume you're speaking of getting a few scenes that they can remaster and put in because obviously they don't have the money to negotiate with CBS about remastering the series because that would cost an extreme amount of money. They raised $647,891 during the Indiegogo campaign, which ended on March 11th. And that was 423% of what they were originally aiming for. If you didn't contribute yet and you still want to get in on the perks, you can't do it on Indiegogo anymore, but you can do it on the documentary website, which is ds9documentary.com. That's DS and the numeral 9 documentary.com. And you can go there and pre-order the Blu-ray. They have bundles for the premiere in LA, New York, London. You can still get your name in the credits, which is something that Matthew and I have both done. So we'll have our names scrolling by as supporters. So there are a few things that you can still get. I don't think you can get some of the perks that they had during the Indiegogo campaign, like the little pin buttons with the character faces. I think those are all gone at this point.
Yeah, that's right. I think some things like that, like the pins, you could only get during the campaign. But yeah, I contributed. I got the, you know, name in the credits and the poster and the Blu-ray and the pin, the whole pin set and all of that. So they had a lot of fun stuff that was going on. But it's good that you can still contribute to it and even get your name in the credits and the Blu-ray, or, you know, maybe go to a premiere. So it's good that they still have that available.
Absolutely. So to share a few of the tweets, and I'm reading these from the article on TrekCore. Rick Berman said, 3.5 hour filmed interview went very well. Ira was terrific. Made me really miss DS9 and all the talented people involved. This one I really like, especially the photo. This was tweeted by the DS9 documentary team. And they say, watch out, Ira Steven Bear. Jake Sisko's all grown up. And they've got a picture of Serac Lofton there with Ira. And he's tall. And what really struck me is how he's starting to look a bit like Avery Brooks did as Sisko at the time that the show was being shot.
I could definitely see that. Yeah. And he's just beaming and smiling and having a good time. But yeah, you could definitely see him looking like Sisko at the beginning of the series. I mean, I think that's interesting too, because of, you know, apparently the close relationship that grew up between Serac Lofton and Avery Brooks during the show, where it was almost like a father-son relationship off camera. So,
absolutely. Yeah. There's also one here from David Livingston, the director, and I'm really glad to see that he was involved because he directed 17 episodes of the series, and I love hearing not only from the actors, but I love hearing from the creative team and what they were thinking, whether they're writers or directors or even the lighting crew, for example. But here we have David, who was a director, and he just said, thrilled to be included in the DS9 doc. DS9 rules. And I assume this is maybe after they were talking to him. Also, I love this photo of Hana Hate, who played, and again, that's the Japanese pronunciation. Maybe Hate is more common there, but Hana played Molly O'Brien on the show, and she was so little at the time, and she's grown up now, and it's a really cute photo of her, and great to see that she's involved and that they brought her in. I'll be very curious to hear what she says, because she was so small at the time, and, you know, I have very little recollection of my life at that age, and I'm curious to know what she remembers about being on the show. And she said, thanks for having me be a part of the DS9 doc. I had an amazing time. Heart my Star Trek family so much.
Yeah, that was great. I mean, one thing that's really great is that they are bringing together, you know, so many different elements of the show. It's not only the, you know, the main actors that are involved, but it's, you know, recurring characters or people who were, you know, just there in certain episodes, like Molly, and writers and producers and directors. I feel like we're going to get a really nice, well-rounded picture of what was going on behind the scenes.
I think we will, especially with the last person I'm going to mention here, which is Robert Hewitt Wolf. Having the writing team involved is extremely important. That's the thing that Matthew and I always talked about on The Orb, that if they couldn't get everyone involved, if they could just get the writer's room together, so we could just hear more about what was going on in their minds as they were writing this, that would be wonderful. And Robert Hewitt Wolf wrote, had a lovely time chatting DS9 with Ira Steven Bear for DS9 Doc. Running into Nana Visitor and Jonathan West was a big bonus. And he hashtags that with family. I've been lucky enough, you know, Larry Nemechek and I, every year we produce these CDs called Trekland on speaker. And they're from Larry's archives, all the interviews that he did over the years, stretching back into the 80s. And those things are on cassette tape, and Larry digitizes them, and then we go through, and I do the restoration, and I do the editing of the audio, and we piece it all together. Luckily, I've been able to hear the full recordings, which have not been released. A lot of it hasn't been released as part of the CDs, because it won't fit on the CDs. They're quite long. And so I have gotten to hear quite a bit of stuff from interviews he did with the writers of DS9 at the time. And it's just really fascinating to know what they're doing. And so I'm really excited that this stuff's going to come out now for all DS9 fans to be able to hear directly from the writers as they sit together on this documentary. I'm just so happy that this is finally happening.
Yeah, it's really wonderful. And one of the things that that I'm really excited about as well is that they got some of the writers together. I think it was Ira Stephen Bear, Robert Hewitt Wolf, Ron Moore, Renee Echevarria, and maybe a few others to actually break what a first episode of season 8 would be like.
I
can't wait to see. Wait to see what they came up with or what that was like, because, you know, of course, it leaves the show in a place where I think there's a lot of different directions you could go. The books have gone in a certain direction. It would be interesting to see what direction that they are thinking of now, all these years later. So that's one of the elements as well that I'm excited about the whole thing from all these aspects, but that's kind of a unique thing that'll be really great to see.
Yeah, for sure. And again, we're talking about this at moments here. We're talking about it like, hey, there's this DS9 documentary. It's so exciting. And of course, you've heard about it because it's been going on for a long time. But we're bringing it up today to share the fact that all this progress is being made and that they have this video vault and you can still get some of the perks if you want them. And the reason I'm reading these tweets is that these are the people who were involved and they've actually sat down, they've shot this stuff, they're putting it together. You can see the momentum of the documentary. So this isn't one of those, we'd love to make a documentary and we've got the ball rolling, but maybe it's hard to get people together and eventually we'll get it done. There's just a lot of momentum behind this and we're actually going to have it before we know it. And that's what's exciting to me. So I did want to just touch on it and share the fact that it's rolling along. And before we know it, we're going to be going behind the scenes of DS9 at last.
Yeah. And I think for the timing, they've said late 2017, early 2018. I hope they can just time it to coincide with the 25th anniversary of DS9. That would be perfect if they could do that.
Yeah, absolutely. And that would be January
3rd.
2018. Yeah. So that would be perfect timing for sure.
Yeah.
All right. Well, the other thing I want to talk about today is the fact that at long last, and I've been waiting for this for a long time, all of Carl Sagan's books are out in audiobook format, thanks to audible.com. Now, this is not an Audible ad. Of course, they are a sponsor of the show, but I'm not really doing an ad spot here. I just want to share the fact that LeVar Burton is involved in this project. And for those of you who love Doherty, who love LeVar Burton, and who love Carl Sagan, you can now get it all together in the form of Cosmos. I purchased Cosmos yesterday. The books came out on the 30th of May. So just last week, I grabbed Cosmos. I was listening to it this morning before we recorded because I wanted to hear how LeVar sounded. There was a video clip released, and I'll put a link to it in the show notes, that Audible put out where they talk to LeVar, they talk to Seth MacFarlane, who is also involved in narrating not only Cosmos, but quite a few of these books. Also, Neil deGrasse Tyson and Druin, who was Carl Sagan's wife, about it. And there's a clip of LeVar in the studio reading a little bit, which is really nice. But I wanted to get in and really listen extensively to him. And he does just a wonderful job. Cosmos is one of the most legendary books about science and the universe. And of course, Carl Sagan was the great popularizer of science in the 70s in particular, and moving forward. And that baton has been passed, in my eyes anyway, to Neil deGrasse Tyson today. I most closely associate Neil deGrasse Tyson with Carl Sagan in that sense, although there are others who are doing the same thing. This book it's just wonderful. I highly recommend that people get it, particularly with LeVar Burton being involved. In fact, let's play a clip.
The cosmos is all that is or ever was or ever will be. Our feeblest contemplations of the cosmos stir us. There is a tingling in the spine, a catch in the voice, a faint sensation as if a distant memory of falling from a height. We know we are approaching the greatest of mysteries. The size and age of the cosmos are beyond ordinary human understanding. Lost somewhere between immensity and eternity is our tiny planetary home.
Justin, we were talking about on the other side of the room.
The other side of the room.
Carl Sagan's works a bit, and you said you were most familiar with Contact, right?
Yes, that's right. So, I mean, as far as Cosmos, I was actually too young when, you know, Carl Sagan's Cosmos came out to have any kind of awareness of it until much later. My real first awareness of Carl Sagan was actually seeing the movie Contact with Jodie Foster, which kind of blew me away at the time. I thought it was an amazing movie. And it caused me to go back and read the book by Carl Sagan, which, of course, is even more fantastic, and to appreciate his work in that way. So I'm actually much more familiar with Contact. And for Cosmos, you know, I have an awareness of its impact and its importance, and I've seen some of it, but it's not something that I experienced like so many people did at the time, because I was just too young to, yeah, to be aware of it.
Well, in addition to the TV series, Carl Sagan and Andrew Ng, they wrote the book version to be a companion for the TV series, the original series. And I highly recommend just reading the book, too. I had seen the series growing up because I grew up in the 70s, but I later read the book itself after not having seen the series for a long time, and it stands up perfectly well just as a book, and it's really fascinating. I should correct myself. I said a moment ago that all of Carl Sagan's books are now available as audiobooks. I should say they will be soon, between now and July, because some of them are not being released until July 25th. There are a lot of them. So right now you can get Cosmos, which has LeVar Burton as the narrator, and The Demon Haunted World, Science as a Candle in the Dark is available. That's narrated by Seth MacFarlane. And Pale Blue Dot, A Vision of the Human Future in Space is there. And also Contact, that's been available for quite a long time, and that one's actually narrated by Jodie Foster. In terms of other Carl Sagan books that will be coming up in July, The Dragons of Eden, Speculations on the Evolution of Human Intelligence, which is a really interesting book, Shadows of Forgotten Ancestors, Billions and Billions, Thoughts on Life and Death at the Brink of the Millennium. Of course, Billions and Billions is a phrase that Carl Sagan became famous for. And lesser known books like The Varieties of Scientific Experience, A Personal View of the Search for God, Broca's Brain, Reflections on the Romance of Science, which is also a really interesting book, Murmurs of Earth, The Voyager Interstellar Record, Comet, and A Path Where No Man Thought, Nuclear Winter, and the End of the Arms Race, which is another one of those books that Carl Sagan would co-author with people. Those are all coming out July 25th. I remember reading, I mean, I've read, I think, all of these books. And in 1997, I think it was, I had this job here in Tokyo, which I had a long commute like I do now. And back then, we didn't have iPods, we didn't have iPads, we didn't have mobile DVD players or anything like that. So I would read all the time. I used to read so much more back then than I do now, and they were paper books as well. And I remember during that year, I just read one Carl Sagan book after another, and I went through all of these. So I'm really excited about this. And the Star Trek connection again is LeVar Burton doing Cosmos. So I highly recommend you check it out. Again, as I said, this isn't intended to be an audible promotional spot, but I will tell you that if you want to get the book and you want to help us make these podcasts at the same time, you can do that. And you can get the book for free if you're not already an Audible member. Just go to audibletrial.com/trekfm and sign up for the trial, and you'll get a free book and you can choose Cosmos. And if you're already a member, then you can just grab it there. It's very affordable. It's $13.22 for members, or just one credit. It's a wonderful purchase. It's 14 hours and 31 minutes altogether. And just great for broadening your horizons as well with science in the world we live in today. So I guess, Justin, I did turn it into a commercial there at the end, didn't I?
Well, you kind of backed into it there, but
no, that wasn't the intention. I just want to promote Carl Sagan's work because I think he was a very, very important thinker. And I really think that everyone who cares about science or cares about our place in the universe really should read all of these books.
Yeah. Well, and it sounds like there's a lot for me to check out. I had no idea he'd actually written so many books, and the only one I've read is Contact. So,
which is a novel. Yeah. And the other ones
are more of a novel. The other ones are nonfiction. But yeah, there's a lot that I need to check out then for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. All right. Well, that's it for the news segment. So let's bring in Luke and Aaron and talk about Enterprise. Sometimes it would be nice to have a transporter. What Star Trek fan hasn't had that thought? But would we really want to be disassembled atom by atom and put back together somewhere far away? Hoshi certainly didn't want to in the second season Enterprise episode Vanishing Point, but it was her only way out of a deadly situation. Today we're going to discuss that beam out and its consequences, and to help us do that, we're joined by the host of our news show, Hyperchannel, Luke Weir. Hey, Luke, welcome back.
Hello, hello.
Good to have you with us today. And with the promise of a Star Trek toy in a box of breakfast cereal, we have lured out of the wood-paneled den the host of Saturday Morning Trek, Aaron Harvey. Aaron,
hello.
What do you think about this little toy right here?
You know, I want to make sure that it's in a good condition, you know, because if you know, I might have to get it on eBay, if not... You know.
No. Yeah. Well, this one's unique. I don't know if people remember those little tiny NFL helmets that you used to get out of the vending machines.
Yes.
In the 70s and the 80s and the 90s. Well, this is the same size as that, but it's one of those little Spock helmets with the red light on top.
I want one of those now. Because if I don't get one of those by the end of this episode, I'm going to want my money back. Oh, wait, I didn't pay anything. Never mind.
All right. So today we're going to talk about Enterprise, and we're going to talk about what's actually one of my favorite Enterprise episodes, Vanishing Point, which may surprise some people. Before we get into the full discussion, though, we always share our initial thoughts. And Luke, why don't you go first and share with us your first thoughts about Vanishing Point?
Well, I'm glad you said that because Vanishing Point was actually one of my favorite Enterprise episodes too when I first couple times I saw it. So, yeah, I really like these types of psychological stories, the types that really get into a character's head and bring in some of those thriller elements, mystery, maybe even a little bit of horror sometimes. So, yeah, the first couple of times I saw this, I just really loved it. I thought it was one of my favorites of the series. I mean, with most mysteries, it kind of... The novelty wears off after multiple viewings a little bit, but I still enjoy this one a fair amount. So, and it's a Hoshi episode too. I really like to watch those episodes that really feature Hoshi and Travis. They kind of got underused in the series, I thought. So yeah, I like this one.
Definitely. How about you, Aaron?
Yeah, this is again one of those guilty pleasures almost, although I don't really want to say guilty pleasure because I just liked it. It was early on in the run, so we got a little bit more of the... you know, you're just out there exploring. We haven't got to the Zindi arc. There's not all the later drama. So I think it was fun just to like, oh, we're getting to know this character. We're she's worried about space, and this is sort of her internal fears and stuff. And it does have all those fun elements of other past, you know, the 600 plus other episodes to draw from in Star Trek. So you get bits and pieces that you recognize, but sort of reshuffled in a new way.
How about you, Justin?
Well, let's see. For me, the first time I saw it, I think I really enjoyed it. I was wondering what was going on and trying to figure things out. And it is nice to have an episode that's focused on Hoshi. But, you know, as I've rewatched it a few times, it has lost a little something for me. And now I think of it as kind of almost like an average episode. I think there are a lot that I enjoy more. So, sorry, I'll be a dissenting voice here and say that, you know, there are a lot of elements that I enjoyed in it, but it's kind of far from my favorite Enterprise episodes.
Mm. Okay, that's good. We need a dissenting voice. For me, like you said, Luke, the fact that it's a Hoshi episode, I really like. I think she was severely underused, and I think
definitely.
Linda Park did a really nice job in this episode, and they could have done a lot more with her character. I also like these types of psychological stories, and you wonder what's going on in someone's head, and it makes you question reality and what is reality and how much of our own thoughts create the world around us. And even if many of us agree that this is going on, this is reality, you know, is that a collective delusion of what's happening?
Sure.
And that's an interesting subject for me. I also like having this sort of early exploration of the transporter, which we'll talk about soon in one of our first sections, but it has just stuck with me. I think largely because it's a Hoshi episode, it has just stuck with me as one of my favorites.
It was interesting. You were talking about like how reality at the very end, I don't know if we're jumping to that point, where she basically faces her fears inside of her own head. Mm-hmm. And you have the whole, is this real, is it not? Does it really matter at that point? So she did accomplish something that later has an impact on her in bits and pieces. It just didn't happen in real life, but she experienced it. So, you know, much like Picard and the Inner Light, like there was an experience there, even though nothing actually happened. So, I mean, not that same impact, obviously, but, you know, that.
And those memories, although we don't hear much about it through the series, those memories do stick with him afterwards. So for him, it was real.
Yeah.
And I think in this case for Hoshi, this is also something that was real for her.
Yeah.
And does stick with her because she clearly remembers what happened at the end. It just happens that it's the end of the episode, and so we don't get to find out anything else. But it may only be 2 seconds for everyone else, but for her, it was an extended period.
Right.
And I think they also say at the end that they're going to make a change and compress the transporter beam after that. So there is actually a like something that changes to make it safer so someone doesn't have to go through such a lengthy experience in the future. So that's
until
interesting.
Until Barclay.
Well, yeah.
He gets stuck in the beam.
Well, Barclay's got a lot of other problems.
Maybe
contributed to that. But of course, it happens throughout Star Trek where they're unable to resolve the transport. They're unable to bring someone back for a while. We've, of course, got Scotty, who survives inside the pattern buffer for 75 years. We've got people who actually die upon transport. We have that in Star Trek, the motion picture. So they don't solve all the problems here, but this is a case of them figuring out the problems that are inherent to the transporter early on, which is actually the first real topic here on our outline. So why don't we go ahead and move into that? We know from the beginning of Enterprise that the crew was very frightened to use the transporter initially. And perhaps in a criticism of the series and in the writing, they jump very quickly to having them use the transporter because it's Star Trek and viewers expect it. And
it's cheaper.
It's kind of cumbersome to take the shuttle down. And yeah, exactly. It's cheaper, which is the reason that the transporter was created in the first place in the original Star Trek from a writing standpoint. But over time, the officers, even on Enterprise, they get used to it. And then throughout Star Trek, as we get on the timeline, everyone grows out of it, except Dr. McCoy, who does it but doesn't like it and would prefer to use a shuttle when he can. And understandably, it would be uncomfortable mentally and frightening to think about being disassembled and put back together somewhere else. You know, I commute 5 hours every single day to go to my office and come back. And I often think, oh, it'd be wonderful if I could just beam to my office and then beam back home at night. I could be like Cisco, where I go to San Francisco, but I go down and have dinner in New Orleans and then come back to San Francisco. That would be nice.
That'd be very nice.
But if I really think about what they would be doing to me each time I transport, I would basically die every day and be brought back in a slightly different form every day. And if I were like Hoshi, you know, my little birthmark would move a centimeter this way and then a centimeter here, and at some point it would be on my back and who knows where it would go next, right?
But that didn't actually happen. That happened in her head. That's where a lot of this is like, yeah, but this isn't really what happened with the transporter. the whole, right, you know, like right. the, you know, Silas Ramsey, she made that up in her head. You know, that, actually, that brings
Aaron,
me to a question.
Cyrus Ramsey is real. Shh, what are you talking about?
Who are you talking about? I don't know what you're talking about, Aaron.
Before this episode, did we ever see Phlox transport or see Hoshi see Phlox transport? Because it feels like he's like, oh, so. I don't like it. I've never touched. It's like, it does not sound like Phlox. I think Phlox actually isn't transporter phobic, which I think was interesting because they're like,
Well, that could be. Of course, we're kind of mixing up transporters and only in my head here on our outline, but that's fine. That's what we do on the Ready Room. It could be that in her head, because she's frightened of it, she expects everyone else to be frightened of it. And so she's projecting that onto Phlox.
That's why I was just curious. So like, if we knew that, that's what's fun about these rewatches, that we get to see these other little bits and pieces that we may not have ever thought of the first time.
But I would expect that the Denobulans have had transporter technology for centuries, and so he probably has been beaming around.
Right.
That's true.
Although I know his wife's been beaming around.
Yeah. I think they do even say in the episode that it was only maybe Archer and Trip that had transported as part of the crew so far. But
oh, that's true.
Something like that.
You might be right. Yep.
But of course, you know, Phlox has been all over the place on the exchange program and all that. I'm sure that it's something that he's done, but... Yeah. It is interesting how she projects things.
Of course, T'Pol would have.
Yeah. I do like her snotty kind of comment that it was, I mean, this I guess later we can talk about what her perceptions of other people, but it's like, you do realize this was the first time that she transported. It's like, yes, I'm very aware. It was sort of like, yes, we've heard it a million times. I'm so scared. Ooh, you know, it's like.
That would have been awesome if T'Pol had really done this little ooh, so scary with her hands. And
then you would have known it was that would be funny.
All right. So what other thoughts do you have anyway about the transporters and how we see them presented early in Enterprise and the fact that apparently, I mean, in reality, right? Like Star Trek is completely real, and this all happened in the 22nd century. If we were there in reality, I'm sure Hoshi is not the first person to use the term beam for the transporters. But in terms of what we see on television and the stories that we know, on the timeline, I believe she is the first person to refer to it as beaming somewhere.
I that jumped out at me. I wondered about that.
So, Luke, what are your other thoughts on transporters?
Yeah, I mean, when you do think about what it's literally doing, I think it would probably be a tough sell for a lot of people. Just thinking in terms of today, how some people just do not care what the consequences of technology will be. They just want to use it and get whatever they can out of it. Other people are completely on the other end. They're just terrified of it. They don't want anything to do with it. And then, of course, the rest of us here in the middle just trying to be responsible, but also get all the fun things we can out of it. So, yeah, I don't know. I have a hard time visualizing how our society would view transporters, at least today anyway.
So what I'm hearing is that if Luke had a transporter, he would just try to get all the fun things out of it. Is that what you're saying?
I mean, I definitely would like to travel all over the place with it, but it'd have to get over that initial hump of basically, I suppose just being destroyed and then reformed again. Somewhere else. Mm-hmm. I don't know if I'd be able to get my mind around that or not.
I just had a thought. If we could truly see the timeline in full, if they could flesh this out, maybe it could be another prequel series. I bet the transporters were invented by Amazon as a way of delivering products to people.
I was totally going to say it's like Amazon groceries would be like, yeah, I don't have to be there, but it can come like beam to my port. It's like order. There it arrived, right there.
You know, that's like, right. Like you've got a little Amazon dot next to the toilet, and you just tap it, and then toilet paper materializes right there.
That's actually kind of interesting. You know, we always hear about technology and how science fiction says, you know, this is what they're going to do, but you're not thinking about the society and how it would actually use it. Like maybe we wouldn't use transporters to go places. Maybe we'd just use it to bring stuff to us and allows us to basically, you know, be even more hermit-like.
That's certainly what we would use them for if we had them right now.
Yeah.
Do we know at this point if transporters are still strictly for military use or if it's being used more on Earth at this point? I can't remember.
I don't think that's ever been stated, because they use it, Starfleet uses it initially in Broken Bow for cargo.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Okay.
So, yeah, I mean, it's a really good question. Like, is the technology widespread enough that industry is using it for the movement of cargo on Earth at that time? Or is it a relatively new technology that the military has created and it hasn't been adopted by civilians yet? I don't know. Good question. That sounds like something Dayton Ward should be able to tell us, I think.
Yeah, that's true.
For sure.
Sounds like a plot point of a book.
It's interesting, too, because they talked about, what is it, in the first transporter tests or whatever in Madison, Wisconsin, if that's actually what happened, depending on what her memory of actually is.
I thought that was called Cyrusville. Wasn't it renamed Cyrusville in honor of Cyrus Ramsey?
Well, it's like,
welcome to Cyrusville.
Did we Population really come up with zero. That? I mean, the transporters. Aliens had transporters when we meet them. So it's like, did we just be like, oh, that's something. Now we should try and develop that. I don't see humans didn't come up with the idea of a transporter because they existed in First Contact. The Vulcans had them. Right?
Right.
Well, you do see it with other aliens, except in the Delta Quadrant, somehow.
In the Delta Quadrant. Yeah. It never crossed their mind.
Well, it'd be like Earth, I guess. But that's my question. It's like, Starfleet, maybe because they saw that other aliens, they're the people who had the most contact with alien species, they're like, oh, okay, there's this thing, let's figure out how to do that, and sort of almost sort of reverse engineering or something like that. Because I don't see Vulcans just handing over, like, here's a transporter blueprint, at the time. So
right.
I'm guessing.
Now, handing over Velcro, no problem. But handing over transporters, no.
The weird thing is I knew the story of how Velcro came to be, and I'm like, that's not right. It's like, it's cool, but it's like it's not at all correct. In that timeline, maybe that's what it is.
Yeah. We're fine with you being able to fasten stuff. We just don't want you to be able to move it around easily.
Exactly.
So I have
any thoughts on transporters, Justin?
Yeah, I have a thought on the transporter. So the way that I think about it is, for all the technology that we see in Star Trek, I think the transporter is the least likely thing that we'll ever see, because there's just so many potential issues with it. And sometimes, people point to stories about quantum entanglement and moving information instantaneously, but it's a huge leap to go from that to disassembling someone and putting someone back together via the transporter. I think we'll have warp drive long before we would have a transporter. I think there's just too many issues, and the alternative we can continue with, you'll use a shuttle or something else to move yourself along. So I think it's fun and I love seeing it in Star Trek, but I wouldn't hold your breath that you're going to see a transporter soon, or even by the time of, Enterprise or Next Generation.
Well, not soon, for sure. Well, that's interesting, because I sort of agree and disagree. I think that transporters to move people around are probably either impossible or something that is far off, hundreds and hundreds of years down the road. But transporters to move cargo around, to move non-living material around, is something that, again, not in this century, but could that be developed? I think it probably is possible. They're already able to move things, not big objects, of course, but to move information over what we would consider pretty long distances, using quantum entanglement primarily. But right. The fact that they're able to do that means that I think it may be more possible than warp drive, because warp drive in theory is possible, but to generate the amount of energy necessary for that is...
Well, that's just a question of the energy for it, though. But I mean, I think the question would become at some point, why would you even think of transporting cargo if you could have, like a 3D printer at the other end of it and just send some specs and, make the thing? Why do you even have to, disassemble it and send it over?
Well, I do think that 3D printers are probably going to fill that need, like you say. That's much more likely than having a transporter, but it's still an interesting technical question and scientific question.
Well, you could combine the two too, if you did like basically the equivalent of the Stargate or some sort of a warp pad of some kind, where it's like it's warping space and time. You're not literally being pulled apart, you're moving from one part of the wherever to another, but just by bending and warping space, so you're not pulling the person apart. It does the equivalent of a transporter, but, you know, step through one end and come out the other, like Quantum Mirror or whatever that was in the Next Generation episode.
Okay, so I have a question. How many times each day would Amazon be warping space, and is that safe for our planet?
No, then you have to have limits, and then it every time you change, you have to announce that you're going to go over those limits, and yeah. No.
Maybe that's only available to Prime customers.
There you go. Yes.
Yeah.
I now we need, you know, like Prime shirts with like a warp thing. This is under a transporter.
Yeah,
that's funny.
Well, so Hoshi's fears of the transporter manifest themselves in this story. And as a result of those fears, as she's being beamed back, while she's in the matter stream, she imagines this whole other world and all these events that happen. But of course, we find out at the end that it's only in her head. The first time you're watching through, you really aren't sure what's going on. And the idea that it's only in her head, I think, doesn't occur to you so easily. But on a rewatch, when you know it's all in her head, you can start to pick up all these little indications that maybe what we're seeing isn't real. So thinking about the fact that according to Phlox, everything happened in the last 1 to 1.5 seconds that she was in the matter stream. And Tripp and Malcolm say she was in the matter stream for about 8 seconds before they were able to pull her back together. So it's only in that final moment, like all this stuff happens to her. And I was thinking about our dreams at night, or even if you take a nap in the afternoon sometimes, if you actually really fall asleep, or sometimes you don't even have to fall into a deep sleep. You have a daydream, or you have a dream at night where the events stretch out over a long period of time. You know, I've had dreams where I wake up and remember that this had been something that was going on for several days or even a week. And our mind just, it feels real. You've probably had those dreams where you wake up and you really thought you were there. And it takes you a few minutes to kind of shake it off and realize that, oh, no, I'm in my bed and it's Thursday morning or something like that and I have to go to work. So our mind does all of these really, really unusual things. And in looking at what's in Hoshi's head, it's this manifestation of all of her hopes and her thoughts and her fears and everything that she's thinking about all the time. And it presents some interesting maybe representations of the characters, her crewmates, life and space, and so forth. So, Aaron, what are your thoughts on what she's seeing, what she's imagining?
I think you get a lot of what's going on in her head as far as her fears, her, I think her insecurities about some of the other crew members, which I think is interesting because you clearly she's at that point where she doesn't feel like T'Pol really pays much attention to her or at least thinks much of her, it feels like.
I was thinking today, in a way, it's like Linda Park thinking about her character on the show and how the writers don't give her enough to do and sometimes forget that she's around.
I can see that. It brought one of my favorite bloopers, actually, which is interesting. It's the scene where she's walking up to T'Pol in the mess hall and she goes to say, excuse me. And at that point, like a piece of something fell off the set and sort of like floated down and it went past her. She's like, things keep falling through me. She was just like, and then T'Pol just like, oh my gosh, I forgot the actress.
Jolene Blaylock.
Yeah. Just bursts into laughter. So it was very funny, but it was like, she had that sort of, yeah, I could see it's like everything is just, I'm the invisible person, you know, as a crew member, as an actress, possibly, you know, it's like, so I did like that. I liked, it's just all the different, she goes to all the different people and the different interactions she has with them is sort of mirrored in that. And she also does that really creepy thing in sick bay where she's sitting on the counter in the background, all hunched up and like she's going to come out of the TV from The Ring or something. I don't know. That was odd. But no, I really liked them using that as a mirror for her characters and some of the her character and how in that those early, you know, years or early beginnings of her character. I mean, unfortunately, we didn't get to see her, I think, develop maybe as much as she could have. I would like to have seen, at least when they do the final episode, she wasn't still like Ensign Hoshi Sato sitting at the same station.
Right.
But yeah.
Yeah, I really liked seeing this device to sort of bring out her insecurities. That aspect was handled really well, specifically her insecurities in doing her job. I think we saw this. It's been a while since I've seen Enterprise. My memory's a little fuzzy. I think we had an episode early on in season one where she's she really loses a lot of confidence in herself and really doesn't feel like she can perform the way she needs to perform.
Well, that's the second episode, Fight or Flight.
Fight or Flight, yeah.
Oh,
she's
right.
Like right out of the gate. Yeah.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. So I like this episode brought that out of her a bit too, with her trouble with the, translating that language and finding out that some low ranking officer who never touched the universal translator before could do it. So
yeah, I wonder what she thinks of him. Like if that's a what's her? It's like, ugh, that guy.
You know? I think that's one of those moments that's more about her insecurities and her concern over her value to the crew, because of course, not only is she the only person on the ship with the skills to decipher this, she's one of the only humans with the skills to decipher this. This is why Archer dragged her into space in the first place, that she needed. She's ultimately one of the creators of the Universal Translator. And that's another of those moments where on even your first rewatch, you start to wonder, like, that just doesn't seem right. You know, something here is not real.
And even going back to trying to pinpoint the very first interaction that seems off, I think he can go right back to Archer coming to her quarters. Just the way he's standing there, the way he's talking to her, it seems a little off even before you're realizing that something is supposed to be off.
Another thing that feels that way is the first time she comes into the mess hall and Travis and Trip and Reed are all sitting there. The way they're talking to each other and the way they're laughing, especially Travis, is just a bit over the top compared to normal for them. So that's also maybe how Hoshi sees them.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'll tell you one place that feels definitely off is when, you know, she's in the ready room and she's of Archer's ready room and she's trying to get his attention by kind of toggling this plasma flow. And then he brings in T'Pol and he's like, huh, it's Morse code. How about that? Maybe we'll look at it in the morning. I mean, that isn't like him at all. He'd be like, oh my God, there's an alien presence, something. Like, we need to get on this right away. And he's just like, I'll just take a look at it in the morning. But maybe that speaks to the way that Hoshi feels about her role and how much Archer might actually value it at this point. Like, he pulled her into space and he's, you know, not using her to the fullest effect, because if there's not translation that's needed, she probably feels kind of useless, you know? So it felt like an expression of those kind of anxieties and feeling like she's not being used to her potential, because you would think if she's there for translation, maybe, you know, she could help out with some other things, maybe learn some things from T'Pol and help with the science station or whatever. But it just feels like she's just kind of waiting around.
I mean, she's on the bridge all the time. She must be doing something.
Something. I mean, it's been a while since I've rewatched Enterprise, so I don't know what other stuff you see her do. I mean, it seems like she's doing something, but you don't necessarily, do you know?
You don't really see her doing too much other stuff, except finding out what Malcolm's favorite food is. Now, that was a very
important
task. That
was very
important,
yeah.
That she had. I guess I kind of picture that she's working on the Universal Translator most of the time, because she...
That's true.
...really... Yeah. Is one of the earliest people to develop that, and it's important to Starfleet later on. But, you know, I'm sure the comms officer has all kinds of tasks that they have to take care of.
You'd think so.
Maybe she's writing, like, dissertations or papers or something, and then she's getting them published.
Ooh, she could be. Or she could be playing Klingon Words with Friends. Just to practice, you know, to keep her Klingon in good shape,
right.
That's all. Yeah. All right. One thing we mentioned earlier in the initial thoughts, maybe it was, about how she overcame her fears. And the first time when she's in the gym there and Trip leaves and she's still stuck in there and she realizes that she can't activate the panels and she can't pick up the weights, she lays down on the floor and she stays in there all night. And it was interesting that she never tried to walk through the wall or walk through the door or something, even though she realized that her hand was basically going through a button. Yeah. I don't remember at that point if we actually, but we do see her try to grab the weight and her hand goes through the weight, right?
Yeah.
And then, if I'm remembering correctly, and then after that happened, she looks in the mirror, she sees herself kind of fading, and then she just lays down and she just stays there curled up.
Maybe she didn't want to like get stuck in the wall. I mean, if she thought
could be. But what I think it represents more, whether intentional or not by the writers, is that at first she's just very frightened of what's going on, and so she just kind of recedes and lays back and doesn't know what to do. And it takes some time for her to start overcoming that fear, because when Archer and Paul leave the gym when they come in that morning and they can't find her, she follows them and while the door's open, she jumps over the little bump at the bottom of the door frame, because she still feels like, oh, I've got to get out before the door closes. And then eventually she realizes that, well, no, actually, I don't need to do that. I can just kind of move around anywhere. And so gradually she's overcoming that fear, which leads to the end when she decides to stop the aliens that she thinks are trying to blow up the ship.
That's true. Although in that moment when she just kind of lays down, I got the feeling where she was just kind of overwhelmed by it. And she's like, this is crazy. Well, that's what I mean. Just need to.
That's what I mean, too.
In terms of what she's able to do, in terms of like passing through objects, these types of episodes where someone becomes invisible or can becomes semi translucent or can go through things, they always have issues with the rules of how this works. Like she can't. I was trying to keep track of what she can and can't do throughout the episode. She cannot fall through the floor. Like she lays down, she's walking. Obviously, she cannot fall through the floor. She can pass through walls. Doesn't figure that out for the while. She can't. Gets to the point where she can't grab anything, but then she can also infect the internal wiring of various things somehow. So it seemed like there was a bit of convenience there, just whatever they needed her to do.
Yeah.
But then how do you avoid that?
It's kind of the rules in her head in this one, but I know that people, you know, a similar one where people are passing through things as the next phase where Ro and Geordi are, you know, become out of phase. But I think that you can explain that a little bit in that episode as, you know, there are certain things that can move between phases and other things that can't, like gravitons from the floor can move through, but maybe sound and light can't. But it feels like this is her, you know, this is something in her head and she can explain it however she wants to. And maybe it is just kind of going through her feeling gradually more confident about doing those things. But yeah, some of it, I remember when I first watched this, I was like, okay, so she can pass through things, but she can affect a plasma flow. How does that even make sense, you know?
Again, because this is a manifestation of reality, it's what her mind is creating as the reality. As she gains confidence at moments, maybe she's then able to work the panel to leave sickbay, for example, or to tap out Morse code for Archer if she feels emboldened, like she feels more confidence in being able to do that. And then when she's more when she lacks the confidence or she feels more scared, then she's unable to pick up these objects. Like it's not real, right? So it is just, you know, this isn't something that we can put scientific rules around, like the next phase, because it's not actually happening to her. It's just purely in her head. It's just a dream, you know, and I can do all kinds of amazing things in my dreams.
Yeah. But they couldn't take it too far. Otherwise you'd really figure out early on that something isn't right here. But I think they have little subtle things like that. Yeah.
Yeah. Those are the things that the more times you watch it, you start to pick up on all these little things, but I think they do a pretty good job the first time through of not showing their hand, and you don't really know what's going on until you get to the end.
If you do watch it, there is no time where you're not at her viewpoint. I mean, everything's always from her. Even when we start to, it looks like it's just to Paul and Phlox and Archer talking, and then they pan, and then she's in that, you know, she's there. Mm-hmm. So, every time you, that's a little bit of a hint too, because you don't ever see an external viewpoint.
Right.
That is true. Although the first time that I saw it, I think, you know, I was wondering what was going on. But actually, when the aliens come up, I was actually convinced at that point that it wasn't real, because there was nothing about those aliens on the planet. And there's this whole story about, you know, being taken hostage and all that. I was like, okay, this has gotten a little crazy. So I was kind of pretty sure at that point that something was going on. But I wasn't sure about it before then. But when that came up, I was like, I don't know. This doesn't seem right, you know?
Well, one of the most interesting things that we learn about Hoshi's thoughts is that it seems that she maybe thinks that her father is a dullard, because the way her father is presented in this episode stands out so much as, like, what's wrong with you? Like, what do you not understand about this call from Captain Archer? My favorite moment is maybe halfway through the discussion, when Archer says she's become a part of our family, and he says, "Family? We are her family, not you." He gets upset at Archer, like, "You're stealing my daughter. Is she Hoshi Archer now? What is going on? What are you talking about?
Daughter? What's a daughter? What's a family?"
And then he asks Archer to call back in the afternoon. Like, maybe by 3 p.m. everything will make sense. Maybe her mom will be home. I don't know what's happening here. It's just very, very...
Well, you know, and this does happen in real life. Like, they know something's really horrible, and they're shocked, and they can't process
it. Yes.
But it doesn't come off as that. It just comes off as he doesn't know what he's talking about.
Yeah. My favorite line is when Archer says there's an issue with the biomatter, and he says, "Biomatter? Is that produce or people?" And I just always laugh because, like, even if you're in shock and you don't know how to process it, that's such a weird line to say, like, produce or people.
The fact that that would come to your mind that you might want to say that.
Well, and then he says Starfleet has deemed the transporter safe. It's like, oh, then Hoshi's safe. Yes, I'm calling you across the universe. Where did I come from? To let you know your daughter's fine.
Yeah,
just got a quick call. I'll talk to you later. What?
Well, let's not give Archer too much credit. His process here for delivering the news wasn't particularly great either.
No.
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 That's true.
It was very, very awkward. Been
very clearly presented what had happened, and it would have made more sense. I've made fun for years of Hoshi's dad in this episode, but since the first time I talked about it on, I think, Warp 5 many years ago, which is our Enterprise show, I have had the experience of my father dying, and people who listen to the Ready Room for years probably know this story already, but in May of 2012, so it's now been 5 years, my father committed suicide. And I had just talked to him a week before, and we had talked for an hour or 2 hours, and everything seemed perfectly normal. There was no indication there was anything wrong. And I was getting ready to go to work one day, and I had to be at work in the afternoon. So I was sitting at home and I was eating lunch, and the phone rang, and I noticed that it was a phone number from the US, which I thought was very unusual. And I was thinking, okay, who would be calling me? And sure enough, it was my aunt, my dad's sister. And I knew something's wrong, because my aunt's not going to be calling me at 12:30 PM. Tokyo time. And she told me that my father had killed himself. And I remember that my reaction was one of those reactions of shock. You know, it wasn't like I started crying. It wasn't like I had a strong reaction. It was sort of just, I couldn't believe what I was hearing. But at the same time, I kind of sensed when the phone rang that something was wrong. And it took me quite a while. I mean, it took me that day. It took me days after that to really even process it, to feel any emotion that would be like what some people might think you would experience of crying or being very emotionally distraught. It's just so shocking. So I can understand Hoshi's dad's reaction up to a point here. And the last time I was watching this yesterday to get ready for this show, until he got to the part about, well, I don't remember what the produce comment, I think it comes before this, and that was a little bit weird, but until he got to the point about not understanding what Archer meant about she's become part of our family, I was feeling that, okay, I kind of get the reaction, like, you don't know what to say, you don't know what to do. But then it just became really weird. And then it makes me wonder what Hoshi thinks about her dad and what her relationship was with him growing up. And,
well, you know, it's hard when your dad's a famous baseball player.
Well, and that's the thing. It's like, you know, Keon Young, who plays Hoshi's father, played Buck Bokai in If Wishes Were Horses on Deep Space Nine. And he's very charismatic in that episode. He's nothing at all like Hoshi's dad here. So it's not a case of an actor who just can't deliver lines.
Right.
This was done intentionally, and I don't really, it doesn't work for me.
It's odd, and it makes you wonder, you know, Hoshi's gotten, you know, all of this education, knows all of these languages. I wonder if she feels like, you know, her dad, I mean, who knows what he does, but maybe he, you know, isn't as smart as she is, and that's just her reflection of that. I don't know. It would be interesting to find out what the story would be. Of course, we don't get one, but it seems like in some way she thinks he's just not as smart as she is. That's the sense I get.
Yeah.
But I think that's maybe internalized, like, not that she would tell people, yeah, my dad, he just doesn't get things. But it's just maybe like inside, something she doesn't normally think about. Maybe she kind of feels like, my dad just never understands the things that I try to explain to him. But it doesn't mean she doesn't love him and that they don't get along well or anything. But when you have this subconscious manifestation of something and then it comes to the surface, maybe.
True.
Well, and he showed up, and her mom did not. So,
I guess her mom worked all the time. Probably that's why her mom was at home at this moment. Yeah,
I was kind of, when we were getting to this part of calling the father and everything, every time I watch this, I always wish we could get more of a reaction from Hoshi, because she doesn't seem to be interested at all in this call. She's only interested in getting Archer's attention. I would have liked to see a little more of maybe her coming to terms with this moment, because, I mean, as far as she knows, this is all real. So coming to terms with the fact that her parents are finding out that she's dead and not being able, being alive in some way, but not being able to do anything about it, I think that would have been a really good way to let us into Hoshi a little more.
Yeah, that's true. Although at the same time, she's probably thinking like, hey, I need them to realize I'm alive, and then you can tell my dad that I'm alive.
My dad that I'm alive. Right?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. But I agree, Luke, that I did have the same reaction watching this last time, because I had not seen this episode for a couple of years. And I was thinking, like, try to get, you know, maybe have a little bit more reaction to the fact that Archer is telling your dad that you're dead. But I do think that ultimately she knows that she's not dead, and her mind is just simply on resolving the situation and thinking that, okay, well, so what? He's telling my dad this now, but if I can get Archer's attention, I can call my dad tomorrow and say, hey, I'm fine.
Sure. Well, we do see her. She does try to wiggle her fingers in the screen a little bit. So maybe that was her way of trying something.
I think that's going to be, you know, WWDC is coming up here in June, and I think Apple might be presenting this as a new capability of the iPad, is for you to be able to put your fingers and control it from the back. It's kind of like the PlayStation Vita has that little touchpad on the back side of it. Yeah.
I'm not sure we need that kind of advancement in technology.
It'll help you not to drop your iPhone or your iPad. Yeah. Get a better grip right through the middle of the screen.
Yeah, or maybe they'll have some phasing technology where you can just manipulate things by having your hand inside of it.
There you go.
That's true.
I don't know why you'd want to do that.
What is the thing where it, like, you know, when you push down and it you have to have a harder push or something, you can just like,
oh yeah,
and you push all the way through. Yeah.
All the way
through.
That's 4D
touch, Aaron. Yeah, exactly. That's Apple 4D touch. All right. Any more thoughts on Hoshi's dad before we move on to the aliens that weren't?
Hey, maybe he's still alive in the 23rd century and we can see him on Discovery.
Or maybe we'll find out that Hoshi's dad was really Buck Bokai. That sounds like something that would happen in the novels, right?
Yeah.
Well, I've always wondered about like the timing or I guess the aging process of these characters in Enterprise, whether or not any of them could show up on Discovery. I don't know.
T'Pol.
Yeah, T'Pol could.
We've seen like Admiral McCoy is 137, so
yeah,
you
we
know.
Could see like True. An Admiral Archer True. That's really, really old.
Well, yeah, it wasn't
really
it
wanted
the,
to connect it
in the very last episode, or no, in the Mirror Universe one, the on screen the his bio said that he died like the day that the Enterprise launched.
Right, 2245.
So he would be would be dead at that point. So we would not
he,
be.
He would if they respect that screen.
If they respect it, yeah.
Well, and in Star Trek 2009, Scotty mentions Admiral Archer's prized Beagle.
Yeah,
so at
right.
least in the Kelvin timeline, he apparently is still around. At that
I
point.
Appreciate
or his dog.
But those events all take place earlier in that timeline than they do in the prime timeline, right? So.
Yep.
By a
Things
little
got
bit.
Shifted by like, what, 10 years or something?
Something like 10 years, yeah. All right. Well, let's talk about the aliens that weren't. Aaron, you pointed out on the other side of the room.
The other side of the room.
And I noticed it this time as well, and I had never noticed it before, that when Trip and Hoshi are examining that stone arch at the beginning, that at the top center of the stone arch, there is a carving of the alien head. And it's not very... Yep. easy to see what it is, but it does turn out that it does look like the two aliens that we see at the end of the episode when they're trying to blow up the ship,
which is fun to think that, you know, she's incorporate like you do with your dreams, like you incorporate things from your day or whatever, and it's like that becomes the alien. And, you know, that they were taking with their Kodak early 2000 camera, the digital camera thing. It was like, oh, this is do something fake at least. I mean, it's cameras in Star Trek just, they never look futuristic, even, they look more clunky than the real world cameras that have existed.
Yeah, like the Doctor's Holo camera in Voyager that's like much bigger than your phone.
Yes.
Well, I think at some point, you know, there was this pushback where technology companies, they keep making everything thinner and thinner and thinner to the point where you can't hold on to it. It's too slippery. It's too thin. It bends in half. And at some point, people just pushed back and they said, just make it a little bit thicker and a little bit thicker. And then we went in the other direction.
I guess like boom boxes, like huge radios.
So here's my question about what you found. I mean, that was a good catch, Aaron, to see that the alien looks like with the carvings that they see on the planet. But my question is, is that a real alien, or is that one that the culture that made it is imagining?
Mm.
Well, I would think that it's probably a representation of themselves, because if you look at our own culture, ancient archways, for example, do have etchings of... Now, it could have been a god, though, right? Because some of our old structures have etchings of what we picture our gods to look like, so we don't know... For sure. But the fact that Hoshi saw it and then her mind used that image to create the two aliens is exactly how a dream works.
Yeah, definitely. It's certainly something I never noticed before, because it's
I had not noticed it before either.
You're distracted by them taking the pictures and, oh, they're at this archaeological scene. That's interesting. So I never focused on the detail of it before.
So, Aaron, were you watching a Blu-ray on a really high-resolution television this time?
No, I was actually just watching Netflix, which I guess has the high res.
Netflix has the high res.
Yeah.
So I've never noticed it before, but in the past, I've always been watching primarily DVDs on a regular 1080p screen.
Okay.
And then more recently, Blu-rays, but still on a 1080p screen. But this time I had downloaded the episode from Netflix and I was watching it on my iPad Pro. So it was really super high res. And with that HD version shrunk down to fit the iPad screen, I could see so much more detail and it stood out for the first time.
But, and the reason I think I saw it to begin with is I was looking for Like, you know, they talk about, you know, what do you think this says? It's like, oh, it says tall people are popular. But I was trying to see if
yeah, like that comment.
Yeah. It's like, is there any kind of like story, you know, beats yeah. that you could get out of, like, did they do something clever and make, like, you know, the pictograms be her journey through this thing? But no, it was just, and then I saw the alien head and was like, oh, well, that actually does show up later. And yeah. he does kind of look like the guy that happens in the next episode, that everyone's favorite, Precious Cargo. looks a little bit like that alien as well.
I did notice that the way the aliens move and when they're talking to each other, trying to arm the bombs, a little bit of Last Outpost Ferengi going on right there.
Yep. Mm. Or the, what is it, Fantomi and the aliens that were in the void. In Voyager, the ones that ended up talking yeah. with music, and they're like
the ones,
yeah,
yeah,
actually,
yeah.
I think Doug Jones was actually one of them, wasn't he? Or no, was it?
Yeah,
no, there's it's so. Oh, the guy who played Hugh on he was Fantomi,
Jonathan Del Arco.
Yes,
thank yeah, you. Jonathan okay. Del Arco. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
His name constantly eludes me. I can see his name, and 2 seconds later, it's gone. I do not know why.
Names. I'm good with names until I try to speak them, and then they just vanish out of my head.
You can type them, but you just can't.
To a lot of people.
Yeah.
No, like, then I can't remember the name.
Oh.
Like, I'm going to tell someone something, and then I get ready to say it, and I can't remember the name anymore.
And yeah, speaking of the name, I mean, one thing we haven't talked about is actually the name of the episode, Vanishing Point, which is, you know, I guess in art, it's where you have two, you know, let's say lines that kind of vanish into the distance. That could even be a hint about the episode, that, you know, eventually what's happening just kind of vanishes into her dreamland. And I didn't really think
it's
about
like
it before.
It's like the road in the opening credits of Enterprise. It just beats the vanishing point at the end. And it says based upon Star Trek, created by Gene Roddenberry. Yeah, that's a good point. You know, that could be, there are actually multiple meanings for vanishing point as the name of the episode, and that's one of them. And another is the point where Hoshi would just disappear completely if she doesn't figure this out.
That's true. That's true. So on the aliens, one thing that I think is interesting as well is that they're speaking this language that she can't understand. And, you know, when I first, I mean, it seems to make sense because she doesn't have the universal translator, but she seems so good with languages, and sometimes she'll just speak to an alien and kind of figure out what they're saying over time. But I don't know if that's just a reflection of her still not feeling confident about those skills. But I always thought that was an interesting part, where I think it's, you know, one of those areas. And I like this when you see it in Enterprise, where somebody's speaking and you don't know what they're saying right away. It's just as they would experience it, like, here's an alien language and I have no clue what they're saying. And you just have to judge it by their actions. I just like when we see those kinds of things in Enterprise, which we don't see quite as much, you know, in later Star
Trek. It's much more realistic, right?
Yeah.
Well, I think that's exactly what is going on here, is it's her insecurity, because earlier in the episode, she has the whole conversation with DePaul about the fact that this crewman quickly deciphered the language when Hoshi couldn't. And so she's feeling like, I think she's had at this point, she's had to deal with enough alien languages that she was unfamiliar with, that she probably worries about letting the crew down when she finally encounters a language that she can't deal with. Because really, in her dream, this is all in her head, she could understand any language that she wanted to understand. So if she was feeling confident, she would easily have been able to understand what they were saying. So the fact that she couldn't, to me, really does highlight the insecurities that she's feeling. Any thoughts on the aliens, Luke?
Well, I just thought it was interesting that this is one of the very few alien species we see in Star Trek that aren't actually real within the world of Star Trek. These are kind of entirely fabricated. I mean, based on the ruins, they probably did exist at some point, but the way we see them, they're completely from Hoshi's imagination. So I think that's really interesting.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, I think we were having a little conversation about this before, but I think there are a couple of other places where that seems to happen. I think even in Enterprise and Strange New World, there's some aliens that they're imagining on Archer 4, including the rock people. In the episode, Voyager episode 1, 7 imagines this alien that I think it's a species that doesn't really exist or that we haven't seen before. And I think there's even those those aliens with muskets in the TNG episode Hide and Q that I think Q is just making up. Yeah. But yeah.
Okay,
but,
yeah.
But sort of Ursinoid kind of, yeah.
Yeah, but that weird. Don't seem to exist anywhere else. But it's true. It's something that's, you know, across 729 episodes and movies, it's something rare, even in when someone is having a vision or an illusion, it's usually of a species we've seen, you know, those humans or Vulcans or Klingons or Zindi or whatever. But yeah, it's one of those few times, and that's kind of interesting. I mean, although if they are real, you know, and coming from that carving on the planet, but... You know, it's unclear. I always thought that they weren't real just because of how it's presented. But yeah, it's unusual that they created it. I mean, and also they didn't even give, I think I was looking at it and even in the notes for the episode, they didn't even give any names to the species or the aliens. They just called them Alien 1 and 2, which I think is, you know.
Yeah, but that's not completely unusual in Star Trek. Yeah. There are a number of episodes where the planet is never given a name, or the species is never given That's a name, true. And sometimes the characters are never given a name.
Yeah.
I think the aliens, the rock people in Strange New World, I really think they don't exist at all. That was purely a hallucination. I feel like these aliens probably did exist on this planet long ago, but like you said, there's no evidence for sure. There's no proof that they did. I guess there is evidence, which is the carving, but that's not proof.
And because, I mean,
as we were saying earlier, that could be what they thought were their gods or something.
Sure. And how they move, how they talk, what they're doing really is entirely fictional. All we really know concretely is the vague shape of their face.
Well, final point before we get into our final thoughts is third verse, same as the first, the fact that, as you just mentioned, Justin, there have been 729 installments of Star Trek, and this is the 663rd. So it's natural that at this point, there are going to be similarities between a story and stories that have come before. This one echoes The Next Phase, which we've talked about a little bit, Realm of Fear, Timescape, Coda on Voyager, where Janeway is seeing, you know, Chakotay thinks she's dead, and she's seeing it from outside as if she's there, but no one else can see her. So there are a number of stories that aren't exactly what's happening here, but there are enough similarities that it maybe makes you think that, oh, I've seen this before. Can't they come up with something new? What connections do you see here? And I'm also curious if it matters to you personally as a viewer when you see Star Trek repeating themes like that.
Yeah, so I mean, every time I've watched this, I've thought of The Next Phase. I mean, that's the one because, you know, she kind of passes through things. But I also think of Realm of Fear as well because of, you know, Barclay's fear of the transporter. And, you know, there are the other examples you gave. Like, it doesn't really bother me when it's kind of like a remix of some other things you've seen before, as long as there's something compelling about it or it's being done in a different way. I mean, there are examples where, you know, it's kind of a little too close to the original idea, like the Naked Now in TNG, which you see it and you're like, oh, I've really seen this before. And there's not that much of a new twist on it, except there are some different characters. But
well, they even pull up the original Enterprise in the records to find out
how
they're like with the situation.
This happened somewhere before. Look, it happened on this other Enterprise. I mean, they're just specifically referencing it for you. It's the way they called it
other Enterprise. Like, no, it was your, like, the lineage of the same ship you're on. I mean, it literally is a different Enterprise, but that was an odd way of phrasing that.
It was. So there are cases like that where it does bother me, and I find it hard to enjoy it because it seems like such a ripoff. But I think in this case it isn't because, you know, the twist that they have on it where, you know, all of this is kind of compressed to a couple of seconds, I think is something that's a little bit different than what we've seen before, and it is something that, you know, is revealing a lot about her character in a different way than, say, you know, things were revealed about Barclay's character in Realm of Fear. So, you know, I think it's fine in this instance, and it can be fine when there's things that are, you know, have similarities, but they're, as long as they're putting a different twist on it, it's fine by me.
Yeah, I tend not to mind as much when you see similar ideas. I can't think of a time when there's been something happening in two different series of Trek where it just seems like a complete ripoff. I do understand to a certain extent when we start to get into Enterprise as well, but specifically Voyager, where there starts to be a few of those vague ideas recycled from TNG. That's one area where I can, even though I love Voyager to death, I can see why some people would have some frustrations with it, given the similarities between some of those episodes. Like the I'm terrible with episode titles, but thinking of the TNG episode where Riker is accused of murder, and then they sort of do that again in Voyager with, I believe, Tom Paris is accused of a murder and his memories are manipulated.
So it's a matter of perspective and ex post facto.
Film noir. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think both of those, in both those episodes, they use those ideas in interesting ways, but it is pretty similar. So I can't help but wonder if when things like that are starting to happen, I can't help but wonder if maybe it's a sign that showrunners have maybe that they've run their course a little bit. Running TV for over 10 years, I think that would be exhausting for anyone, but especially with all the work they've done.
I actually kind of like when they would, well, they repeat ideas, because you get to see how the characters that are in the show that you're watching experience it compared to other series. I kind of like the bringing back different, you know, experiences that other people have gone through. It's just because it there's something universal about it that it ties all the different series together. It's like, oh, that's when, you know, it's not exactly the same, but it's like it's similar to, you know, the Inner Light, or not the Inner Light, sorry, like the Next Phase or what have you. So I don't mind that. I like repeating themes as long as they are not literally repeating the same plot and the same beat and everything like that. And I think there's enough different going on in here that it's okay. But it is getting towards the, like, you know, I enjoy it personally, but I can see how other people could say, like, we've seen this before, and there isn't enough new material brought to the you know, story.
Yeah, it doesn't bother me typically. One that's often cited in Enterprise is Oasis, and people say, well, it's just a remake of Shadowplay from Deep Space Nine, and you've even got Rene Auberjonois in both of them. But to me, they're different enough that I enjoy them, and you do get to see a little bit of a different take on the idea. And I think as a creative professional myself, I know that when you produce that much content, you're going to start to have the same ideas creep in here and there. You would see it, you know, as a designer, you're going to have similar themes that crop into your work. And as a writer, likewise. But I definitely can see where some fans might feel that way and it might not work for them. Here it's enough of a little bit from here and a little bit of there to create a story that is unique, that it works all right for me.
And the actress is fun to watch. I mean, she seems to actually enjoy what she's doing and gets into the role of like, oh wow, this is, you know, this is weird. This is happening to me. Hello, can anybody see me? You can sense her frustration. Yeah. She does a good job of that. It doesn't feel like she's just sort of like, ugh, I've got to get through this episode.
Yeah, I think Linda Park does a really great job in this episode. Well, let's do final thoughts and our rating. So, Justin, why don't you kick us off?
Okay. So, at the beginning of this discussion, I know that I said, you know, I really liked it at first, but it hasn't worn as well in rewatches, and it feels kind of average for me. But as we've been talking about it, I realized that there's a lot more insight and perspective you get into Hoshi's character and her, you know, the way that she thinks about the world and where she is at this point in the series. So, I think I've, you know, gotten to appreciate it more from our discussion here. And I was also thinking about, you know, this is, I think, the first episode that's really centered, well, I guess that's not exactly true, but this is one of the episodes that's really centered on Hoshi, and she doesn't get very many. And the other one I think about is the season 3 episode Exile, with, you know, the creepy telepathic alien in the castle during the Zindi arc, and and this one definitely reveals more about her and is more interesting. So I think through this discussion I've gotten more of an appreciation. I mean, I do think it's a really good episode. It's really, you know, well done. I did enjoy rewatching, but I did think, oh, it's kind of average. But yeah, I think I've come to appreciate it more. And as far as a rating, I think I'd give it 4 out of 5 transporter buffers.
All right. The ready room effect is working on Justin. We've brought you around a little bit. All right. Luke, how about you?
This episode has... I've cooled on it a little bit the more I watch it, but I think I'll still stand by. It's one of the definitely one of my favorite episodes of Enterprise, just for bringing in bringing the focus to Hoshi and being able to explore these really interesting ideas. So yeah, I really like it. I really like when Star Trek does this, even in TOS. Even though I'm not the biggest TOS fan, I really do appreciate that they sometimes will delve into more abstract ideas. I think it's something that the later series sort of abandoned a little bit. So I really appreciate it from that. And so yeah, I think this is a flawed episode, but it's still really fun anyway. I'm going to have to give this 8 translucent reflections out of 11.
All right. 8 out of 11. Perfect. All right. How about you, Aaron?
Yeah, I've now watched this episode probably 3 times in the last 2 weeks, and I don't want to watch it again right now, but I did not begin to like get irritated by it or anything. It's like, oh, I found new things as I watched it, so I appreciated that. So I that is one good thing about an episode. If you can find that and you can find different things, then it's doing its job. So even though it's not the most engaging Star Trek episode ever, I like the bits and pieces of it. So it's where the pieces are greater than the sum of the whole, maybe, or something. That I don't know if that's the best way to say it, but yeah, I think it holds up. And I give it, let's see, 4 out of 5 rating. Wait, what's a rating? Is it a family? Is it produce? I don't know. If I knew what a rating was, I would give it 1.
All
4 out of 5
all
very
right.
Confused Hoshi's fathers.
Yes, all right. Thank you, Hoshi's father, for that. All right. My final thoughts. I think this episode highlights why they should have given Linda Park more to do, and they should have done more with the character of Hoshi on the show. I really enjoy, as I mentioned at the top, the psychological element and the questions about reality. And I also think this is a good episode that never makes the list of episodes of Star Trek for Halloween. Ah. But I think it's a nice little under-the-radar ghost story in a sense. And I always include it in my list of Halloween episodes. So I like it quite a bit. And I'm going to give this episode Cyrus Ramsey's autograph. All right. Well, before we go, Luke, tell everyone where they can find you around the network and around the interwebs and whatever you have going on.
All right. You can find me hosting Hyper Channel on the Trek FM network, working on an episode that I bet will probably be out by the time you hear this, all about the new VR game, Star Trek Bridge Crew. So excited to talk about that. And you can find me on Facebook to search for Luke Weir. You can find me on Twitter at Craptastic Luke. It's like fantastic, but with a crap instead of a fan.
Very good. All right. And Aaron, where can people find you and what do you have going on?
You can find me as the host of Saturday Morning Trek, the network animated series / all things Trek in the 1970s podcast. We're rounding up the end of season 1 of the animated series. We actually have more episodes than there are total episodes of the animated series, which I don't think any of us thought that would be possible. But right. We've had some really good interviews, and what we've started doing now is we're doing some watch-alongs, which are a lot of fun, and it's nice to kind of step away from the research role and just sort of like react to the episode. So that we put a poll in the Babel Conference, which is our Facebook user listener group, and asked some of the people what they'd be interested in seeing. So we're going to start working on those, and then we will be moving into season 2. And you can find me on the Babel Conference, and you can also find me on Twitter under the username GeekFilter. And I'm the network art director, too, so you can see some of my work on some of the podcast covers and bits and pieces here and there.
Yep, and often popping up in the Babel Conference as well, your artwork.
Oh, yes.
Yep, so people can find it there. All right, well, thanks again for joining us today, guys. It was a lot of fun.
Thank you.
All right, thanks.
Well, Chris, it was a lot of fun talking with Luke and Aaron about Vanishing Point. It actually changed how I felt about the episode on the rewatch, so I'm really glad that we had this discussion.
Good. That's our goal on the Ready Room. That's actually not our goal. So our goal is just to foster a good discussion and explore the various viewpoints. But it is always nice when we can encourage somebody to watch or maybe to enjoy an episode that they weren't as fond of before. That's happened to me too. You know, we've come into episodes where I wasn't really a big fan of a particular episode. And after we've had a discussion like this and I listened to everyone else's viewpoint, I came around too and learned something new about the episode and saw something new in it that raised the rating a little bit for me on whatever scale I use.
Yeah. And I realized we learned more about Hoshi in this episode than just about any other in terms of getting into her head and what she's thinking. And so it's really great for that. And I didn't really think about it in that way before. So it's actually been enlightening.
I'm just always disappointed they didn't do more with Hoshi.
Definitely. Well, Hoshi and Travis, yeah.
Hoshi and Travis, yeah. But I really think there was so much because of her role with the Universal Translator and her role as a linguist and the way that they present, as we talked about a little bit in the discussion, alien languages sometimes where they don't even bother to subtitle it. You know, as the viewer, you don't know what these people are saying. And I think that's great because that's the way it would be in real life. So it was, yeah, really good discussion. But it's not the only thing we've been talking about here on the network. So here's a quick look at some of the other things we've been discussing on Trek FM.
Previously on Trek.fm, Melodic Treks.
I think one of the things, though, that still attracts me to his music is that whole dissonance. Having something be not quite perfect. Two notes that seem like they should be on, but one of them's just slightly off. Not enough to be flat or sharp, but just enough to make you notice. And he uses that a lot in his music.
Literary Treks.
It's not just about Q. Do you remember Trelane from the original series? The episode, The Squire of Gothos? He was played by William J. Campbell, a.k.a. Koloth. But Trelane's character in the original series is very similar to what we got later with Q, and he may have been some of the inspiration behind the Q character.
Saturday Morning Trek.
The line that I thought was really interesting, "Twist me Widdershins," mean a direction contrary to the sun's course, considered as unlucky, counterclockwise. So instead of saying, "Twist me counterclockwise," they said, "Twist me Widdershins."
So they use the word Widdershins?
Widdershins.
That's a word?
Yes.
That's
a
real world.
A child in 1973 should have known, apparently.
Wow. That is... I missed that, and I don't ever want to hear the word. It's a terrible word. It's a terrible word.
The Ready Room.
Well, Larry, you know, in this case, in the writer's room, the real question on Discovery right now is to hoof or not to hoof.
Oh, no. Well, my thing is to three finger or to five finger. So,
What will they do with the Tellarite hands?
I mean, the Klingon forehead's got an example, an answer. When are we ever going to have a reason for what happened to the five fingered Tellarites versus the,
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
So check out all of these shows and join the conversation about your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe and beyond. Star Trek Beyond's over. I miss doing that. But anyway, your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe and beyond. You'll find us wherever you get your podcasts. If you're an Apple user, be sure to hit the subscribe button in Apple Podcasts on iPhone, iPad, or Apple TV, or the desktop iTunes app to get the latest episodes as soon as they are published. They'll be pushed right out to you if you're subscribed. If you're just looking at the pages in the store, you may not see them for a while. It takes a little while for that to update. But while you're there, if you have a moment, please leave us a star rating and a written review. I'd really appreciate hearing your thoughts there as well. If you're not an Apple user, we've got you covered. You can find our shows on Google Play Music, Stitcher, TuneIn, Spreaker, SoundCloud, Windows Phone, and most third-party apps. Of course, you can stream and download the MP3 from our website or grab the RSS link. And this show, The Ready Room, is actually also available on Spotify. It's the only one of our shows available on Spotify at the moment. Spotify's been very picky about this sort of podcast rollout that they're doing, and they just picked a few shows, and this happens to be one of them. So if you are a Spotify user, you can hear me there as well. Now, I would love to hear your thoughts on today's show, what you think about the DS9 documentary, about Carl Sagan, about Hoshi and Vanishing Point. Maybe you have some thoughts on the episode that we didn't touch on. We'd love to hear what you think about it. There are many ways for you to do that. The best place is to join in the larger conversation in the Babel Conference. That's our listeners group on Facebook. Just type Babel, B-A-B-E-L, into the search field on Facebook, and it should come right up. If you'd like to send us an email, you can use the form on our website at trek.fm/contact. Choose to send to a show and choose the Ready Room from the drop-down menu. That'll come right to me. You can also find the network on Twitter. Our username there is TrekFM. And on Facebook, our regular brand page is facebook.com/TrekFM. But again, I recommend the Babel Conference as a great way to have a discussion with other listeners and really extend the show beyond the end of the podcast here. So Justin, one thing I want to tell everyone, I don't think we've really announced this yet because it's kind of a new thing, but you have joined the crew as the content manager for the network. And so what that means is that you're going to be a liaison between the hosts and the audience for ideas that the listeners have for things they might want us to cover. Now, of course, the hosts talk to the listeners as well, but it's great to have one person to really help coordinate all that, and that's going to be you. And of course, you'll be working with the hosts to develop shows as well. So welcome aboard as content manager.
Thank you. I'm very excited about it and what I can contribute to the network.
So tell me, you know, as a listener, because you've been a listener for a long time before you're taking on this role, I mean, what's an example of something when you've been listening and you've thought that wouldn't it be great if the hosts did this, or wouldn't it be great if we did a series of episodes on this?
Well, you know, one of the things that I think would be really interesting, actually, I'll give credit to my wife for this idea because we were talking about it, but, you know, there are lots of people that listen to the different shows on Trek FM, and I think that it would be, you know, interesting to hear from them a little bit about how Star Trek's changed their life, because I've heard different stories on Facebook and on Twitter about how Star Trek has had a huge impact on people's lives. So I think it would be, you know, really interesting to get, you know, some listener feedback on that, so that we can, you know, hear about how the influence that Star Trek's had on people's lives.
Yeah, great point. And anytime we can get listener feedback, it's wonderful because we, you know, we want these shows to be a two-way communication. You know, it's not just about us sitting behind the mic and just talking and saying, you know, here's what you should think about the episode. It's more about here's some ideas, and then let's continue to talk. And so that's a great point. So everyone, if you want to share some ideas you have for Trek FM, Justin is your man. You'll find Justin in the Babel Conference, of course, but Justin, where else can people find you?
You can also find me on Twitter. My handle is TrekFan4747, where I tweet about nothing but Star Trek.
Very good. All right. And you can also send Justin email through the website, again, trek.fm/contact. And you can choose to send a suggestion through there. Very good. Well, if you want to find me elsewhere on the network, that would be The Orb, our Deep Space Nine podcast, which I do with Matthew Rushing. And you can also find my writing on the official website at StarTrek.com. And on Twitter, you can find me where my username is C. Brian Jones, the letter C, and Brian with a Y. I did admit this past week that the C stands for Covfefe. I'm sorry to keep that under wraps for so long, but, you know, I just wasn't comfortable, and I've been using this Chris pseudonym for years to try to fit in. But now I feel like it's okay for me to open up about the real name that my parents gave me, which is, of course, Covfefe. You can also find me on Facebook, where my username is C. Brian Jones. That's my username pretty much everywhere. And you can find me in the Babel Conference. Well, Justin, I also want to take a moment and thank our associate producers here on the Ready Room. These are the people that help us keep this show going every week with their support through Patreon. And so I want to thank Renee Roberts, who has been with us since the beginning of the network. We love Renee. Also Zachary Fruling, who's now a host on the network, doing Meta Treks and To the Journey. Meta Treks is a philosophy podcast, and To the Journey is our Voyager podcast. also Sam Piasek, Kay Elizabeth Shaw, who is with Zachary onto the journey, Tim Robertson, David Shuford, and Ju Kim. Thank you so much, all of you guys, for your support of The Ready Room. If you would like to become an associate producer and support this show and support all the shows on the network, you can do that through Patreon. Just visit patreon.com/trekfm. That's patreon.com/trekfm to get all the details. We have all kinds of perks for you, including early access to episodes, exclusive content, producer credits, and more. Those are available through our special patrons website called Patron Zone, available to all supporters from $5 per month and up. We also have the Patrons Roundtable at $15 per month, and that's a chance to get on with other listeners and hosts, just like we're doing right now, recording this show, and talk about a Star Trek topic every month. So if you are interested in this, just visit patreon.com/trekfm. It requires a great deal of money to produce, host, and distribute these shows each month. And we really, really appreciate any support you can give us. We hope you'll join our team. We really appreciate all of our patrons so much. Thank you from me personally, from the bottom of my heart, for your support. It's only through that support that we're able to keep this network going. So thank you so much. Again, you'll find all the details at patreon.com/trekfm. All right, Justin. Well, that's everything we have to talk about today. So I'm going to head on back down and call Hoshi's dad because I really need to explain to him what the difference is between produce and people.
Well, I hope you're able to do that because it's hard to tell what he can understand in Hoshi's dreams.
Very true.
But it's time to stick a transporter buffer in it because the Ready Room is done.